Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. 8:06 on this Wednesday, May 29th. 55 degrees currently here in Old Town Park City. And before we get to meteorologist Thomas Giboy, just a heads up, somebody had sent us some footage of a vehicle on fire. The car is now in the median on I-80. It looks like the car was traveling westbound just over Parley Summit towards the Salt Lake Valley. UDOT estimating that both lanes, both directions will be backing up as firefighters' crews get into the area. So if you are headed in either direction on I-80, there near Parley Summit, you may want to just wait a bit and let them get that cleaned up. We'll bring you more information as soon as we find out about it. But let's get to the weather again. We've got 55 degrees here in Old Town Park City. Feeling like summer. On the phone with us, Thomas Giboy from the ABC Forecast Center.
Well, good morning, Leslie. Happy Wednesday to you. And I can actually build off of what we're seeing up around Parley Summit. I'm actually looking at the camera right now when we do our traffic reports, and it looks like they got that fire out. So hopefully they get that clear here relatively soon. Both lanes do look like they're slowing down at least a little bit. So anybody going up and down Parley's Canyon, making your way from Parley Summit down through Parley's Canyon, we'll probably want to build in some extra time just in case. But for today in Park City, we're going to be looking at another pretty nice day. It's not going to be quite as warm compared to what we saw yesterday, and that's thanks to a weak cold front that's going to be moving across the northern half of the state. So instead of a daytime high in the mid to upper 70s in Park City like we saw yesterday, we'll come in right around 70 degrees while we could sneak into the upper 70s down in the Heber Valley. But as we go from this morning into the afternoon, you'll likely start to see cumulus clouds begin to bubble up, and there will be at least the potential for a few isolated showers and thunderstorms from this afternoon to this evening. If I put a percentage on it, it's probably about a 1 in 3 or a 30% chance that a shower or thunderstorm finds you across the Wasatch back. So while the chance of wet weather is not all that high for any outdoor plans, keep your eyes to the sky just in case. By tonight, you'll definitely notice that that's going to be a little bit cooler as the overnight low in Park City heads for the upper 30s, which is, I would say, more reasonable for this time of year. And then for our Thursday, likely going to be the coolest day of this next seven-day stretch. We'll see a daytime high in the low 60s, but with mostly sunny skies, still should be a really nice day. High pressure briefly builds back in as we go into a Friday and Saturday. That's going to allow temperatures to warm right back up. We should be right around 70 degrees for our Friday, upper 40s by Friday night. And then on Saturday should be the warmest day of the weekend with a daytime high coming in at 76 degrees as we keep mostly sunny skies. Between Sunday and early next week, there'll be 2 week systems that really clip the northern half of the state. At this point, doesn't look like either system will bring much in the way of any appreciable moisture. So the chance of wet weather will stay low as we keep mostly sunny to partly cloudy skies in the forecast. Both Sunday and Monday should see a daytime high in the low 70s in Park City, right around 72, 73 degrees, with mid to upper 70s down in the Heber Valley. On Tuesday, we could top out right around 70 degrees, but as I'm looking a little bit further when it comes to the forecast models, by the middle and second half of next week, a dome of high pressure could build in, and it could be one of the strongest high pressures of the season, allowing for temperatures to climb maybe even warmer than what we find on Saturday. So for the next 7 days, just looks like a relatively quiet and warm stretch. We just have that chance of showers and thunderstorms this afternoon, and then Thursday, tomorrow, will likely be the coolest of this next stretch going forward, Leslie.
Okay. Thomas, thanks for those weather and traffic updates. Appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Well, stay tuned. Coming up, we'll be talking with award-winning speaker, strategist, and former climate advisor at the Obama White House, Molly Kawawata. She'll be joined by E.E. Sue with Park City Community Foundation. We'll be talking about Kawawata's visit to Park City next week. Then from the Park City LGBTQ Plus Task Force, we'll be talking with members Virginia Solomon and Cammie Richard. They have details on Pride Month, as well as a community picnic and the announcement of a new name. Well, the Park City School District and community members are discussing cell phone use in schools. KPCW's Christine Weller has more on how they're working together to address students' mental health.
A group of Park City parents and Park City School District administrators gathered last week to discuss how cell phones affect youth mental health. Parents Maren Mullen, Katie Wright, and Holland Lincoln set out to organize a gathering to discuss The Anxious Generation by Jonathan Haidt. Haidt argues too much screen time and too little autonomy have combined to cause a mental health crisis in America's teenagers. What they uncovered, however, was a big demand for a broader community conversation about parent concerns. The trio worked with the Park City School District to host a panel discussion with Treasure Mountain Junior High Principal Caleb Fine and Summit County Health's Pamela Bellow. Mullen said over 90 parents, many who want to delay their kids' cell phone use, attended.
We're hoping to have an open dialogue, to see how we can, you know, all come together and play a part in rolling back a phone-based childhood so that we can help our kids thrive.
Fine said having cell phones in schools is a complex issue. School districts don't buy them, but they're everywhere in schools.
Managing that becomes a teacher issue and a teacher reality, and that can be very frustrating because kids are kids, and they are likely to be impulsive at times. And if a mom or dad texts a kid during class, which does happen, it's highly probable that student's going to want to look at the phone.
Most students have a cell phone by the time they get to Treasure Mountain, and Fine said it comes with pros and cons. Among the positives, cell phones help some students with reading challenges by magnifying fonts, and they can help with monitoring student health needs. Further, a lot of parents like being able to get in touch with their child without having to go through the front office. However, Fine said while cell phones aren't allowed in the classroom, they can still be a learning distraction. He said even adults can relate to hearing their phone buzz and needing to drop everything to look at it. Fine said social media is also designed to be addictive, and while Treasure Mountain students are collectively flourishing, phones can still negatively affect students' mental health.
We, like every school in the nation, are dealing with students that are dealing with anxiety. We have students that are dealing with depression.
The Park City School District recently emailed a survey to secondary school parents and staff to gauge how parents and staff feel about cell phone use in schools. Fine said the district has received over 900 responses and plans to use the information to guide future policies on cell phone use. Another panel discussing cell phone use in schools will be held June 5th from 6 to 8 p.m. at Edgar Hill Middle School. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Well, coming up next Tuesday, the public's invited to join the Park City Community Foundation for an evening with Molly Kawahata, an award-winning speaker, climate advocate, and former climate advisor at the Obama White House. Molly joins me on the phone. Also in the studio with me, I have E.E. Hsu, the co-chair of the Climate Fund Steering Committee for the Community Foundation. Good morning to both of you, ladies. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning, Leslie. Thanks for having us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
All right. So, E, let's just start with you for a little bit of background here. What's happening next Tuesday, June 4th?
Well, we are so excited. This has been over a year in the making. If you remember, we established a goal last year of zero food waste by 2030 with Park City Community Foundation and the Climate Fund. And we are there. We are less than a week out to launch the first phase of the Zero Food Waste Initiative. And this is going to be centered around residential curbside food waste collection. So it's going to be a community-wide initiative and program. We're super excited for it, and we've invited Molly to come be a part of this launch. We're super thrilled that she's going to be here on Tuesday, June 4th. She is so inspirational, and she has a great message for all of us.
Okay, well, so who's invited? How much? When and where? And
Anybody in the community is invited. We hope everybody comes out. We're hoping for a sellout crowd, and we think we're gonna get there. Tickets are $10, and you could go to our website, parkcitycf.org/events, to purchase them. And it's anybody in the community, anybody who's interested in environment and climate, anybody who wants to be inspired by this amazing speaker, Molly, who we've invited here to be a part of the community and be a part of this event.
Okay. So it's happening Tuesday, starting when?
Tuesday at 7 p.m. at Santee, Park City Library.
All right. Well, Molly, let's bring you into it here. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your role with the Community Foundation's new composting program, again, as he said, to reach that zero food waste goal by 2030.
Yeah, well, thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be able to come out, in part because I've had the honor of getting to work with the Park City Community Foundation, members of the community there who have, you know, really taken it upon themselves, as he describes, to take action on climate and, you know, not wait, realizing that, you know, we can all step up and take action in place of others. And so that's one thing that's just absolutely incredible and inspiring. We need that in the climate movement, our members of communities who can rise up in grassroots efforts. And so it's been an absolute honor to get to work with Park City Community Foundation throughout the last few months on this new program, and I'm so excited to be out there. For me, I am a former climate advisor. I was at the Obama White House, and I'm now the founder of Systemic Impact Strategies, and I speak on the science of hope and how it can be applied into climate and other efforts.
So you're acting as a consultant then with the Community Foundation's efforts?
I have in the last few months. I've been very lucky to get to work with them and learn from the amazing residents there.
All right. So what did you do as climate advisor for the Obama White House?
Yeah, we were working on a lot of domestic climate mitigation policy. And you know, from that, I had this moment at the White House at 3 a.m. I was sitting at my desk, I remember, one night, and I had this sudden realization, right, that you can't expect to have policy if you can't get the people on board, and we cannot get the public on board until they feel something. And that led me on this huge journey where I realized that, you know, ultimately what we could do in the halls of the White House would come down to the public and come down to like a human feeling. And so I started looking into, you know, this idea that, you know, maybe the climate problem isn't a policy problem or a persuasion problem. Maybe it's actually a problem around communications and the messages we've instilled in the public, the emotions we've instilled in the public. And so I went into psychology research thinking about how is the human mind working and how is that impacting our work. And one thing is incredibly clear, which is that fear, guilt, and shame is antithetical to motivation for long-term action, right? If you want to build a movement long-term, get people involved, fear, guilt, and shame is actually not a good strategy, and that's what the environmental movement has been using. And that's when I also discovered the science of hope, which is an emerging area of positive psychology. It's backed by over 2,000 published research studies, and saw that hope is not just this idea that feels good or this fluffy concept. Hope is something that's incredibly effective. And when we can use research-backed communication strategies on climate, we get a lot more people on board. So what I'll be talking about is how to apply the science of hope, all of this research-backed, all of these research-backed strategies, to the climate movement in order to make it more accessible, more welcoming, more just, and ultimately more effective.
Yeah. Well, you know, growing up, I mean, I've kind of given the generation ahead of me, they just didn't know better. But I don't feel that same feeling, as you put it, from the generation behind us. And it's mm-hmm. I feel like a lot of guilt and shame, and you should have known better, coming from them to my generation. And I think, I don't know, I feel like we're doing the best we can.
Yeah, absolutely. I get to work with Gen Z a lot. And one thing I can tell, I mean, that's one of the things that gives me the most hope in this space, is the way in which they're approaching this issue. They're not focused on, you know, the idea of sustainable living. They recognize the importance of it, but they're really focused on systemic change, which is where we really need to focus a lot of our efforts on changing the system, fixing it, and solving climate for everybody. There's a much bigger environmental justice component with it in their work. And so I think there's so much that all of us, myself included, have been able and to can keep learning from them in that space.
Yeah, so how do we do that, though? You know, on our show, This Green Earth, yesterday, the host spoke with a senior research scientist at the National Snow and Ice Data Center, who kind of broke down the data that shows that the summer Arctic sea ice shrinking 12% every decade due to our warming temperatures. So where do we go from here? I mean, it just doesn't seem enough anymore to install the solar panels, to drive an electric vehicle, to stop eating red meat, to have compost piles in our backyard.
So, you know, what I can say is that what we've seen, again, when we look at research-backed strategies, the science of hope is incredibly effective. And what that is it's breaking down into a framework of three things. Well, the first thing before those is that it requires a truthful assessment of the problem. So anything that minimizes the problem, right, like the silver lining people, the Pollyanna people, is by definition not hope. It looks straight up at the problem, and because of that, it's very tied to innovation in the research. And it's required, like, three things go into it that create this formula. It's goals, which need to be feasible and desirable, right? The goal needs to be doable. It needs agency, which is the idea that you have the power to make things better. And then you need a pathway, which is their strategy, your roadmap for action. Goals, agency, pathway, gap. That's our formula for spreading hope. And within this research, hope is defined as the belief the future can be better and that you have the power to make it better. Without this part that you have the power to make it better, they would not get the results they're getting in the research. And those are everything from hope has been shown consistently to help cancer patients live longer. It has been shown to give a 12% bump in student outcomes. It has been shown to help athletes of equal level outperform other athletes. On equal level, hope being the defining factor. You know, lower divorce rate among high hope couples, every single domain, we are seeing incredible results using this GAP framework, this hope framework. And so because of that, that's when I was like, let's apply that you know, bring that out of the labs, bring that out of these other domains, and let's stick into the climate space and see what we can do with that. We are seeing that it's been very effective in all of these different domains for climate, whether that's helping build a more effective and devoted climate workforce, right? Like we know that we're facing big burnout challenges that are very understandable within the climate workspace. How can we address it there? How can we address it within climate storytelling? How we're telling stories, how organizations are, how as a movement we're telling that story. In order to tell a hopeful one, because it makes people more likely to act on a CTA. I mean, across the climate movement, there are applications here that we found to be very effective.
Yeah, and when you talked about, you know, the fact that we have got to feel something, is that a bipartisan feeling? I mean, are we seeing that? I mean, it seems like it's a cause that the Democrats have really rallied around. I mean, are we seeing it now from the Republicans as well?
Yes, it's such a good question. So within the public, the majority of American voters, taking both political parties into account, are behind climate action. Climate policies are actually incredibly popular in America. And this is about double what people perceive, right? We often think maybe, you know, it's 50-50, right? 50% climate action, 50% of the public, climate denier. Not true at all. Climate deniers are a very small percentage, overwhelmingly small percentage in America. And so what we really need to realize is that there is currently a discrepancy between where the public is and where Congress is, right, where the representatives are. And, you know, we could do a whole other segment just on democracy reform and how democracy reform is climate action because of this, right? But really what we're seeing is that the voice of the people across political parties, across states, geographies, their voices aren't being heard. You know, some of the most underrepresented people in Congress from a communications perspective are pro-climate action conservatives. And so it's really, really important that we're recognizing across the, you know, the landscape that it's actually an incredibly bipartisan, popular, non-controversial, not political issue. And one of the ways we can really tap into that is how we frame climate change. And when we frame climate in terms of public health, rather than talking about polar bears dying and glaciers melting in the Arctic, what we found, again, from a mainstream communication strategy is that way more people are on board. So when you frame climate change in terms of clean air, clean water, and pollution, people really start to pay attention. And so that's why, you know, we often talk about very real impacts of climate change on communities of color who are likelier to have to live near things like, you know, power plants, highways, toxic waste sites. And because of that, see some of the highest asthma rates in the country, you know, increased hospitalization rates, increased rates of cancer, heart disease, lung disease, miscarriage, right? Like the list really goes on. And so when we think about it in terms of those human impacts, we definitely have a more effective frame that one is more inclusive, recognizing how communities of color are most impacted, and also is more effective.
Yeah. So when we did see the passage of last year's Infrastructure Act, you know, almost $45 billion, part of it, which was to go towards kind of the climate crisis, that's a good indication that we are working together to move forward on this?
Yeah. And, you know, there is this, I mean, going back, so you're talking about the Inflation Reduction Act, mm-hmm. right? Yeah. So that's been an extraordinary policy. Is it, is it perfect? No. But, you know, in policy world, we're excited to get a policy that can get us, you know, cut a few emissions, you know, use a few percentage points out of our emissions. And this is going to lead to a 40% net cut in emissions, ultimately. I mean, that's a significant number. And when we ask ourselves, how do we get there? You know, again, we often don't talk about this climate elections nexus. And, you know, the number one question I get from people is like, what can I do? Which is my favorite question. And they often think I'm going to direct them, you know, ride your bike to work or, you know, do your laundry after 9 p.m. or some individual action, which, again, is great for those who have the time, energy, privilege of doing those things. However, to solve climate change, it's a different animal. We need to look at systemic change. And we get that through helping win elections. Because, again, we know the public is behind climate action. So ultimately, we just need to turn environmentalists out to vote. And there's an amazing group called the Environmental Voter Project that I work with very closely that does this. But when we look at the IRA and why it got passed, it ultimately came down to, it was very close. Community organizers who are on the ground in Georgia
and they were organizing largely under Stacey Abrams. And ultimately, she and they, flipped a state everyone had said had no chance of flipping, which were environmental voters, ultimately. And because of that, got two new senators who were the margin of victory for getting that passed. You know, we barely got it passed. And so ultimately, like, individual action comes down to systemic change in turning out these voters in order to get big action, right? Because we need action like the IRA. We need more IRAs. But ultimately, you know, to bring this back, these are some of the topics we're going to be talking about at this event that's been hosted by the Park City Community Foundation. And for me, I'm so inspired by this community, which is really exemplifying what's best in us. It's this idea that we can't wait, right? And when people are kind of standing around, looking around, being like, why aren't more people acting? We need to act. There's this idea that we can take it into our own hands. And that's what this community has done in Park City. And so that's why I am so excited to be able to come out and be with you all.
Okay. Give us an idea of what the evening will look like. I think you're starting it with a film that Molly's part of.
Yeah, what Molly didn't mention is she's the subject of a Patagonia film, and so we'll have a sneak preview of that. It's a shortened version of the film, and then Molly will have her keynote speech. As you can tell, she has so much experience, and she's here to inspire us, and I'd love to tie it in, you know, back to our community, because the zero food waste goal is a community goal, which means that Molly talked about agency. Every single person in this community can be involved, and we hope that they will participate. Everybody has agency. This is going to build hope in our community. We need everyone to be involved, and we're super excited about this.
Yeah. You had mentioned kind of that first phase of that residential food. So tell me, give me a...
We're called Residential Curbside Food Waste Collection. Join us on June 4th. We're going to have a press release June 3rd. You're going to get all the details then. We hope everybody who's listening comes and joins us that evening, gets to meet Molly. Super excited. This is a huge milestone for our community.
Okay.
Thank you. And if I can add one thing, you know, really what's happening here is this program is part of systemic change, right? You have an organization, a community-wide effort that's going to scale this wide, right? And help solve this for everyone, right? If you are participating in this program, you're part of this effort that is going to be scaling and having systemic impact. And that's what we're really looking at. So anybody who participates in this is making that happen. And that's why I'm so excited to be a part of it.
Yes, and everybody in this community will have an impact. That's the cool part about this.
Okay.
Absolutely.
ParkCityCF.org/events. Okay. Looking forward to it. You expect to sell out, so people should go online now to get their tickets.
Yes, please do.
Okay. Look forward to meeting you, Molly, and thank you, EE.
Thank you.
Again, looks like we've got some updated details there. The vehicle on fire was actually eastbound I-80, just over Parley's Summit. Right now, they've got that left lane cleared, so it looks like traffic westbound is doing okay. Eastbound traffic looks like it's backing up. Estimated clearance time here, probably in the next 15 or 20 minutes. Well, the Park City LGBTQ+ Task Force kicks off Pride Month Saturday with activities aimed at educating and growing awareness in Park City and Summit County. I've got task force members Cammie Richardson, EJ Elliott, and Virginia Solomon in the studio now with details. Good morning.
Good morning. Leslie.
Cammie, maybe start with tell us what Pride Month is and why we're celebrating it.
Well, I think thanks to the city, they've declared this Pride Month for the month of June, and it's a celebration of who we are and what we are to the community, and I think it brings us together with the community so that we can share our common values.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about the task force, Virginia. I think it sounds like you guys are undergoing some changes.
Yeah, exciting changes coming up. So we want to let everyone know, don't worry, soon you won't have to keep saying the Park City LGBTQ+ Task Force. Come to the flag raising on Saturday and you'll hear the much shorter, snappier version of what we'll be going with. And then we've done a lot of work trying to move on from the great support that we had from the city and then the great support that we had from the Park City Community Foundation to be our own independent 501c3. And we're just in the process of getting paperwork finalized to get that going.
Okay, so you're kind of breaking ties then with the municipality?
Oh, I'd like to think we're making more ties. Certainly, a lot of what we do is a little bit outside logistically of what the city likes to support in terms of having events and that kind of stuff. Oftentimes, things got planned on a timeline that aren't really a city timeline. And so just the ability to have a little bit more flexibility in terms of what we do and when and stuff like that. So we're certainly not breaking ties with the city. We're very appreciative to have the ongoing support of the city, but just doing it a little bit differently, and also the county as well. They newborn parent brain happening right now. But they also passed a resolution to have June be Pride Month in the county as well, and so we're happy that we were able to get that for the first year this year as well.
Yeah, so the task force, Cami, I mean, just a little background here, started with Park City Municipal's help, and that was actually done just be given that dismal score from the Human Rights Campaign. I think it's called the Municipal Campaign Equality Index. But I mean, from a score of 37 out of 100, you guys are all the way up to 86 out of 100, so something to celebrate.
Right. Back in 21, the city decided as one of their pillars that they would create a social equity pillar. And thanks to Lynn Ware Peak, who is still here at the radio station, we formed the task force and with the goal of improving that score. And over the years, I think because of our ability to get involved in the community, show our face, do different things, a lot of what we'll talk about in a minute. It's been able to raise awareness of the LGBTQ plus community and raise that score. So we're pretty proud of it. It's the second highest in Utah behind Salt Lake City.
All right, EJ, so what's happening this Saturday?
So this Saturday we have a few events. The first is the flag raising at 10 a.m. We're going to get donuts. We're going to celebrate the whole day, start off the Pride Month with raising the flag, recognizing all the work that's been done with the task force so far in the city. And then after that, we'll be going right into the picnic. We're pretty excited this year to have the flag raising and the picnic on the same day as June 1st ended up on a Saturday. So the picnic will be 11 to 2. We'll have Mountaintown Music will be there performing. We're going to have lawn games, and it's just going to be a great community event. Bring family, bring friends, bring allies. We're just happy to celebrate this day and start off the Pride Month right.
Okay, so that's all going to happen like the gazebo area?
Yeah, so the flag raising is going to be at Miners Hospital, and then right over to the gazebo is where we're going to be having the picnic.
All right. Now, I know in years past you've had as many as 5 Pride flags flying throughout the community. Are we going to see those in other locations this year?
Yeah, we're already on Main Street with some banners. We've got an exciting month planned. On June the 4th, we're going to be giving out another scholarship to the Park City High School student that was chosen, who's very LGBTQ plus friendly. We're excited about that. And then at the end of June, June 28th at the Boneyard, we're having a community-wide event at the Boneyard. Up on the deck, there's music, a jazz band be playing for us, Beacon Street Experience. People are welcome to come. We'll have some appetizers for people to enjoy, but drinking food after that will be on their own. It should be a great night to celebrate all of us here in Summit County.
Okay, so that's happening at the Boneyard. What time?
It'll start at 6 o'clock. Okay. The band is starts at 6:30 and they'll play till 9:30.
Okay. And I know in years past you've done Living Libraries. You've been part of that. Anything
like
that planned?
We are not doing it this year. I got involved with Summit County Libraries, and we did the Human Library last year, which was very, very successful. And so we've kind of shifted over to their forte, and I think they'll be able to help us again this year do something.
Yeah, and as part of the name, I mean, allies has been part of the alphabet in that. What is it somebody who is wants to be considered an ally? I mean, what is it they do? They show up at these events? Is that a good way to?
Yeah, so showing up at the event, certainly. But there is all kinds of stuff that folks can do to be allies. Being knowledgeable about the needs of the LGBTQ plus community, being vocal advocates in your workplaces, in your communities, in your faith organizations, in your pickleball leagues, whatever the case might be, when you see something happening, speaking up to help people know what can better help support folks, queer folks in town. One thing that's great about Park City in so many ways is that people want to do the right thing. They just don't necessarily always know what the right thing is. And part of what I think we're proud that we've been able to accomplish as an organization is to help people learn what they can do to be better allies.
Yeah. In terms of the upcoming election, any concern there in terms of what we might see?
Oh, boy.
Yes. Lots.
That's a loaded question. You got an hour?
Not today.
You know, I think it's pretty safe to say that, you know, our community has been under attack. It continues to be so through the Utah legislature with their recent trans bathroom bill. And we have concerns. And in fact, June 11th, is it?
Yeah. So June 11th from 6 to 7:30 will be a legislative update with Equality Utah. We're still working out finalizing a location for that event. But if folks want to come and hear about the bills, we all know about that bathroom bill, also the DEI bill. But there are other bills that passed that also disproportionately impact the LGBTQ plus community. And so come and hear about that, like you said, on June 11th from 6 to 7:30. All and right. Also hear about more of the advocacy work that Equality Utah is doing to try and set up for next year.
Yeah, so it's not just a national concern. I mean, it's right here in our own backyard.
Oh, sure.
Unfortunately.
Yeah.
All right.
I wanted to mention just July 4th, we will be marching down Main Street. We'll be meeting right out, probably right here on the street in front of you. We look forward to people joining us. We've had great participation over the years. The love that we feel walking down Main Street is unparalleled, and we just think it's great that our community feels that way. There are dissenters. Mayor Nan has had many a letter from people asking, why are we participating? And I guess the answer is, why not? Why shouldn't we be? We're part of this community.
Yeah, you're Americans. We're celebrating America.
Right.
All right. Anything else that you want to mention about what's going to happen this month?
Well, I just want to finish. The city has been such a great partner with us over the years. We really appreciate their support. We look forward to being an independent organization, doing our own thing here pretty shortly. So it's pretty exciting as we've seen our growth over the years with over 50 members at this point.
Good job. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Leslie.
You're listening to the Local News Hour here on KPCW. And again, join the Park City LGBTQ plus Task Force to kick off Pride Month. That's happening again this Saturday starting at 10 a.m., followed by a picnic between 11 and 2. Well, the National Ability Center is hosting its 15th annual Park City fundraiser this Saturday. In the studio with details, I have NAC's Development Director, Caitlin Magnowski, along with Equestrian Manager, Megan O'Toole. Good morning, ladies. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Thank you.
Caitlin, start with you and just have you give us the details of the fundraiser. It's, I mentioned, this Saturday. When and where?
It is, yes. Right over at our ranch location. And we start at 4 o'clock. That's when check-in begins. We have a lot of really fun kids' activities. We have face painting and a petting zoo, mechanical bull. The saloon will be open for the parents at that time. And then dinner will start about 5:30 p.m. And then the live show around 6:30. And then we'll wrap around 8:30 or 9 with some line dancing.
Okay, so you found that it works well with making it a family-friendly event, huh?
Yes, absolutely. We love that this is one of our very much family-friendly events. Great for the community to come out, everybody be together. And then obviously the important part is supporting the equestrian programs and the participants in that program.
Okay, cost of the tickets are how much?
I believe $65 for an adult and $35 for a kid. Those are, you know, people can go to our website, discovernac.org, and purchase the tickets from the barn party page. And we do still have some tickets available. We're close to selling out, but we do still have some available.
Okay. Well, that's great. A live auction, silent auction, anything like that?
Yes. So we do have a live auction, 10 really cool auction lots, a couple that are repeats from past years that are really popular, and then a few new ones as well. And then we have one silent auction item, which is a yurt glamping trip. So we have a yurt that we run out in the Uinta Mountains. And so that's a 2-night, 3-day guided trip out to that yurt.
All right. As you mentioned, the funds do support NAC's equine program. Megan, maybe tell us a little bit about the adaptive horseback riding, what you call equine assisted learning. How does that work?
We actually have two programs at the NAC. One is the adaptive riding program, and the other is equine assisted learning. The adaptive riding is exactly what it sounds like. It is mounted horseback riding, and we adapt to make accommodations for whatever a person's needs are. So we might use specialized tack. We might use the use of our amazing volunteers to help us with balance or increasing social skills or whatnot. And then our equine assisted learning is unmounted programming where it fosters a relationship between the horse and the human in order to develop confidence and social skills, communication, and whatnot. So it's two separate programs.
Ah, okay. All right. And then that the unmounted programming, what the folks, the participants are with the horses?
Correct. They're in the arena. Depending on the individual, what their goals are, what their disability is, whatnot, we will sometimes have the horse in hand. We have members of staff who manage the horses, but oftentimes the horses are loose in the arena and the individuals are in there with them and participating in different activities. And again, we adapt to accommodate what that individual's needs are.
Yeah, and horses can be frightening, I mean, just because of their size, right?
Yes.
And so what does that help participants get out of? What do they get out of it, though, just by being?
So it is an interesting relationship between horses and humans. They are prey animals and we are predators, so they're naturally wired to be a little bit fearful of us. And so in order to be around them and to keep them comfortable, we have to change how we respond. We have to read their body language. We have to take control of ourselves and approach them in a way that doesn't scare them, that doesn't confuse them and whatnot. So it teaches us a lot about ourselves and gives us a sense of self-awareness so that we can, you know, read the room basically and figure out what we need to do to make it a working relationship.
All right. And you also offer summer camp
programs? We do. Yes. Yes. I'll be honest. I don't have all of the details about that, but yes, we do offer programs throughout the summer. You can reach out via our website or whatnot, but it is usually groups of children. We start at the age of 4 and go up there, and we will accommodate what that individual's group's needs are. So sometimes it is real hands-on activity where they're actually working through with the horses, going over obstacle courses, that kind of stuff. Sometimes we're painting the horses and just having fun activities like that.
How many horses do you keep at the ranch?
We currently have 14 horses in our program, but we are trying to expand. And so we're always looking for more horses that are suitable for our program. And the more horses we have, the more programming we'll be able to offer in the future.
Yeah. Not cheap, though, to board a horse. What does a horse cost you every year?
So our whole program runs us approximately $300,000 a year. And that is for the feed and uptake of the horses, also the salaries of our staff. And so that all of the money that is raised from Barton Party goes towards the care of these horses.
All right. So the horses stay year-round?
Yes. Yes, they do. They live outside. We do have stalls, but our horses live outside. They have shelters and heated water and whatnot, and they are there all the time, yes.
Yeah. And then how many participants do you have in your programs?
Our numbers are increasing, so I don't actually know what our exact numbers are right now. We increased our participant numbers by, I believe, 33% in the last several months. I think we do somewhere around 2,500 participant experiences per fiscal year. But again, we are trying to increase those numbers.
And why is this an important program for the NAC? I mean, the equine programs. What does it do for your
Overall, it is one of our most popular programs. It is one of our most requested programs. We have a wait list because so many people are interested in it. I think it's something that is intriguing to people because it isn't something that is normally accessible to just even the general population. So to be able to come there and be able to experience this, and we have a great scholarship program that also helps fund it. Horses are expensive, so even on just a regular everyday level, a lot of people can't afford that. And so to be able to come out, connect with a large animal like that and have that experience is very intriguing to people.
All right, and you mentioned that you're always looking for suitable horses. What's a suitable horse for the NAC?
They have to basically pass a temperament test. We're pretty open to different ages, breeds, that kind of stuff, but they have to be able to handle a variety of different participants. We have participants with balance issues, with behavioral issues, that kind of stuff. Essentially, our horses are service animals, in a sense, and so they have to be able to handle whatever is thrown at them. So not every horse can handle that. So they go through a rigorous trial process with me, and they have to pass a bunch of tests in order to be able to make it into our program.
Oh, all right. And again, it's not dependent on age. I was thinking maybe the older, the more cooperative, but not necessarily.
Not necessarily,
so.
No.
Okay, so if somebody does have a horse that may, they just couldn't take care of? I mean, is that how you usually get your horses?
We take donations. We will purchase horses. We also are willing to do a lease of horses. It's basically what we call a care lease, where we take over the expense of the horses, but the person still owns the horse technically. So we're willing to go about it however works best for the person who has the horse. They can definitely reach out to me. If they call the National Ability Center, they can get my contact information, and I would be happy to talk to anybody about a horse that they might think is suitable for the program.
Okay. Caitlin, I wanted to touch on this real quick. The National Ability Center was just selected as the host venue for the 2025 Move United Education Conference. What's this about?
Yeah, we're super excited about that. Move United is a huge organization that has a similar mission to ours of providing, you know, recreation opportunities for people with disabilities. And so to host it here in conjunction with our 40th anniversary next year is really exciting. We anticipate about 400 to 450 attendees. So it'll just be incredible to have that many people on our campus, seeing our facilities, using our equipment. So we're really looking forward to it.
All right, so these people attend to do what? I mean, you have speakers or programs?
Yes, there's breakout sessions. In the past, I believe we've actually had a presence at this conference in years past, and there hasn't been as much of a programmatic aspect, but thanks to our very large equipment fleet and the facilities that we have, we are going to try to have a little bit more of that when we are the host next year. But in addition to that, then there's a bunch of different breakout sessions. None of those are set yet. Various adaptive organizations are able to submit what they would like to present on, and then those will be selected as we get a little bit closer.
Yeah, and I know you do have lodging on site, but not enough for 400 people.
We do, no, yeah, but thanks to the Yarrow, I do believe that they are the hotel that has partnered with Move United to provide additional accommodations, which is fantastic. So, yeah, our lodge can sleep about 52, so not quite enough for the 450.
Okay. All right, anything else you wanted to tell us about Saturday?
No, I just that the weather looks great. So if people are looking for something to do, it's a really fun afternoon. Bring the whole family and we'll be out there.
Just discovernac.org. They'll find.
Yes. And then if they just go to the events tab, they'll see the barn party link and they can follow that to the registration site.
All right. Well, Caitlin and Megan, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks for having us.
Park City business leaders say that visitation numbers were up about 3% this winter. But as KPCW Tanner Thomas reports, they are projecting a much slower summer than last year.
The Park City Chamber of Commerce and Visitors Bureau uses hotel bookings to measure how many tourists visit day to day or month to month. Booking numbers from November of last year until April of 2024 beat the previous winter season by 3% on average. That's according to Park City Chamber President and CEO Jennifer Wesselhoff. Still, Park City hotels only beat the average occupancy rate of similar ski resort communities once. That was February, which in 2024 was Park City Mountain's snowiest February on record. So Wesselhoff says there's room to grow. Here she is at the May 22nd Summit County Council meeting.
Right now, summer's looking really slow. Reservations on the books as of April 30th are pacing about 11% behind where we were this time last year.
However, Council Vice Chair Tanya Hansen, who's worked in the lodging industry for Marriott, Park City Mountain, Snow Basin, and Sun Valley, says the industry is generally seeing guests book later and later.
The booking window is the window that guests book between the time they book to their arrival date. And that booking window is getting shorter and shorter.
So there's still time for summer tourism to pick up. But with the exception of October, Wesselhoff also notes that Park City usually underperforms during the summer compared to other Mountain West resort areas. And the Chamber isn't forecasting any growth in the year ahead, winter included.
We are anticipating to be flat for the upcoming year. I think it's just a lot of competition, international competition. The most recent report says that about 39% of Americans are going to be traveling more internationally.
Average daily rates, how much visitors pay to book a hotel room, are flattening out too, she said. Rates aren't falling, but generally the Chamber would like fewer people to visit while also spending more money. That scenario generates the most tax revenue without straining locals and local infrastructure, a key pillar of the Chamber's sustainable tourism mission. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.
And traffic still backed up there along I-80 eastbound. Again, a vehicle fire earlier today pulled off into the median, but we've got lanes of traffic again down with the left lane closed. Looks like traffic is slowing down just past Lambs Canyon, and you'll need to get a couple of miles, it looks like, towards Summit Park, just over the summit, it looks like, when traffic starts to ease back up again. Well, Park City Municipal is creating a new advisory committee to help award nonprofit service contracts. KPCW's Parker Malatesta has the details.
There are more than 120 nonprofits in Park City, and several partner with the city government to provide services to residents. Mountain Trails Foundation is one example, as Park City Mayor Nan Worrell explains.
Mountain Trails is a great example because they groom all of our trails. And if they weren't there to do that for us, we'd have to add that department. So it's much more cost efficient for everyone to have Mountain Trails out there. And they're such a great partner of the city.
Other city-supported services include the Christian Center's Food Assistance Program and People's Health Clinic, which serves the uninsured population. Park City has budgeted $620,000 for public service contracts annually. The City Council has final say over how that money is distributed. Currently, applications from nonprofits for funding are scored and presented to the Council by City Hall employees. Worrell said the city plans to change the process and increase the duration of nonprofit contracts.
We're trying to make several of them a four-year contract instead of having to come back in every 2 years. You know, I sat on the nonprofit side when I ran one for several years, and so I'm well familiar with both sides of the process of applying and the stability that it gives nonprofits to know that they have a four-year contract. We also wanted to increase the transparency of the process, and so we're going to form a new city board.
Members of the Nonprofit Services Advisory Committee would be appointed by the City Council. The board would be tasked with creating and evaluating proposal criteria from nonprofits, interviewing applicants, and providing funding recommendations to the council. According to a staff report, the new committee would likely be formed this fall. It requires final approval by the City Council. Note, KPCW received $35,000 from Park City Municipal as part of a 2024 public service contract for a bilingual reporter to translate news into Spanish. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
And 15 lucky residents will soon be allowed to explore Summit County's 8,600-acre acquisition below Jeremy Ranch. KPCW's Connor Thomas has more on the birding event happening this Saturday.
The June 1st event will provide 15 members of the public with a first look at the 910 Cattle Ranch, a sprawling and mostly untouched property between Jeremy Ranch and Morgan County. Summit County entered into an option to purchase it for $55 million last year and recently secured a $40 million federal grant to seal the deal. While the deal's been in the works, the 910 Ranch has been closed to the public, except to a group of volunteer ambassadors and authorized county officials. It will remain closed until further notice, so the general public should stay on East Canyon Road as the county develops a land management plan. Saturday's roughly 2-mile guided birding walk is an exception. The 15 participating residents signed up on a first-come, first-served basis, and the event reached capacity May 23rd. The county has said it will hold more events this summer, which will be posted at summitcounty.org's calendar. Although the walk itself is full, anyone may attend a virtual introduction to birding online Wednesday from 5:30 p.m. to 6:30 p.m. Volunteer and local bird enthusiast Kimberly Roush is hosting the crash course, and she wants to equip her neighbors with the skills to bird on their own.
You know, if somebody just points out the bird, you learn a few field marks and you see it that one time, but that doesn't give you the background to go out on your own.
Roush has walked East Canyon Road for years and says the land is home to kingfishers, bald eagles, golden eagles, and small fast birds called dippers. The online session will be recorded and posted to the County Lands and Natural Resources website. A link to attend virtually is online at kpcw.org. Connor Thomas, KPCW News.